taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene. Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janoukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Amanda Johnson about her latest poetry collection, Controlled Burn, published by Puncher and Wattman. Amanda is an award-winning poet, novelist and artist. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
It's lovely to be here, Tina.
I'd like to begin with the title poem of the collection, Controlled Burn. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Controlled Burn. The silent man, her neighbour, who is always paid more for less, stock and field, has a mouth full of clattering silver, jowls that shudder pilgrim entitlement, gouty wrath. He breathes in the smoke-blanketed valley, choreographs rollies in quiet, practiced strikes. With men he's loquacious, a trough tap turned on. He calls them all up. Her practice burn must be argued against, her stream access and water rights. Fire is bitch, as he sees it. Practicing control burns, a fool's idea. By Christ, he repeats. But he can't make it rhyme. His new neighbour is a bad spot fire, something to be put out, hosed down, like the boys mucking about the river pastures. In his granddad's rifling time. But he underestimates her cool melancholy, the science and law undergirding her decision not to sell, to stay and defend when fire rushes uphill, to burn down the poet's desk and make shed iron sing. She won't be put out. Let him cut down every tree, suck the fire brigade dry. There's no room in her bunker for him.
Why did Controlled Burn become the title of the collection?
There's a whole sequence early in the book that deal with pastoral or post-pastoral issues, and particularly the onset of fire in recent times due to climate change. Partner and I share a landcare property down towards Cape Otway, and we have a lot to do with farmers from time to time, looking at fire prevention. We're not farmers, but I've learnt a lot talking to them, and there's some really great farmers down there who are, you know, very interested in sustainability and rooting out invasive weeds. They're amazing people and some amazing women farmers who will stay with their animals at all costs. You know, they won't leave if a fire comes. And we ourselves have been evacuated several times during recent Otway fires. But there's also some, well, I hesitate to call them bad seeds, but some sexist farmers who I've just heard them speak in fairly derogatory ways about some of the women farmers in the area, and I wanted to document that or evoke that. And let me reinforce that they're the minority, but it goes without saying that they do exist. And I thought that was an interesting title, Control Burn, which is a term you might often see posted along verges and roadsides where Parks Victoria say might be undertaking a controlled burn, but it's also a metaphor for anger and disgust in a way. So it's evocative in that sense.
Yes, because the book is in two parts. In essence, you're talking about the first part there, but even when I read the second part of the collection, there's a sense of underlying, I might use the term, fury in some of the poems.
Yes, that's true. The book's divided into two sections, Control Burn and then Head Fire. Most of the environmental poems occur in the first section, poems that deal with fire and dispossession of Aboriginal people and environmental themes which open out to a wider global purview. But the second section, in a way, is more psychological. Head Fire implies that. So it's more about psychological states, including the state of anger in the subject or in myself. So it's very cathartic to belt out a few poems about the state of the world in these broken times.
One of the poems that particularly interested me was Mice and Men, which is from the first section of the book. Could you read the poem?
Yes. Mice and Men. Our father wore glow-weave permanent press, pinned in boxes with pearl-tipped pins, manly shirts distributed nationwide, creases ironed out to suggest 24-hour invincibility, sharp futures. "Don't get ideas," laughed my mother, settling into a lungful of sherry on slaves' night off. We set our sights not on the shirts but on the boxes. Inside them, my brother and I built and glued cardboard mazes, arranging cunning cheddar lures. The walls were erratically scaled and cut by chubby fingers. What did we know about life's general obstructions? Our wily navigators would secure the prize. We scheduled the race for Saturday morning, after the cartoons, and before the sword and sandal epic with its gleaming charioteers. In our dark garage stood a blanketed birdcage full of sheared newspapers and sawdust, plastic bowls and tiny circus wheels. Our mice never used wheels, like showy TV mice in white coat experiments. The cage looked empty, a sawdust and paper thoroughfare, as desolate as the kind a killer in a western rides through. I topped up water and food. "Don't do that," my father growled. "They're breeding like crazy. We can't keep them." A burgeoning city of mice slumbered underneath the layered shavings, disguising procreative gift. To peer inside 7 days after a litter birthed was to discover a dim Catholic universe of blind and deaf pinkies huddled like fermenting marshmallows in a sweet, sickly stink. We stroked the pups' rosy noses and ears, curving our starfish hands into tiny cribs. Could red eyes really be that gentle? And the hard question I had not asked our father, faint sweat stain creeping around his permanent press collar. Who would keep them? The day came when my brother was roped in, a manly rite, to help drown them. My mother cried in the kitchen because my brother was crying. The role of small killer come to town did not fit her darling red-nosed boy. He wore no funeral black, just faded green tracksuit bottom. Was neither murderer nor suburban Lenny. Our father gave us a talk, stentorian, uneasy, drumming thick fingers against a mug of warm Milo. "It's like this," he said. "Mice are breeding machines. They gestate between 19 to 21 days. So we're looking at 10 births a year, 10 to 14 pups a time. We can't keep them." The word zoo lurched into my head, shorter than sanctuary. But my psychic mother shook her head, refilled her sorrowful glass and dragged me into a hug. The task required two buckets, running water, a shovel, a deep hole in the end of the garden, one 10-year-old boy, and one 50-year-old man given to bitter musings about passage through the maze of life. Nothing in life was pearl-tipped, cheesily victorious, his set mouth said. Inside the cold, dark garage, the men picked up blind pup after pup by the tails and dropped them into freezing pails like rose-tipped snowballs. My mother and I sat stock still at the kitchen table. I felt my throat buttoned down as if a cardboard gate lodged there. That feel of permanent press, the first run of loss, my heart spinning on a small unridden wheel.
Mice and Men, of course, reminds us of John Steinbeck's Mice and Men. Is that a poem in part about the making of a social conscience?
That's an interesting question. It does operate intertextually in that it quotes from Mice and Men, but here we have, the victim is really the young boy who's forced to participate in this murder of domestic animals. And if, like me, you grew up in the 70s, I just remember backyards being like illegal farmlets full of sea monkeys, goats, chooks, mice. You know, all of it was probably illegal, and there were so many roosters as well. So I have based it on the people who lived around the corner from me during my childhood, and I was kind of a apathetic bystander to this. I held it in mind for all these years, and I don't even know where it came from, Tina, but I was just stacking my shelves and I was putting some Steinbecks away, and I thought, of mice and men, mice, memory. And I thought that would be a good title to use, even though the victims in that story, of course, are human victims, because there's a murder, an unwitting murder in that story. So it's, I guess, a compassionate poem. Well, it's compassionate to the family, and it's compassionate in a way for toxic masculinity that can think of no other solution than death, really. In that sense, it hovers or motions towards ideas of social conscience. How do we care for animals? What do we do with them? How does the death of an animal cause reverberations in a familial context and in the wider society?
Another poem that interested me is Inheritance. And again, that comes from the first section of the book. Could you read the poem for us?
Sure. Inheritance. Gadabunud Country. Lighthouse Road. Cape Otway. I will not leave my animals, as you left me. I remember your shadow tractor flying over rutted cloud towards a booky sun, too keen to bet on hardened pastures, boiled dams, and end-time fire events. Well, not quite over. You pass through cloud and evening's remnant aurora in your sweat-brown, busted straw hat, over paddocks furrowed like brows, your dicky ventricles flunking their last sheepdog trial, that wild race of blood, hope and efficiency, pegging us to time and pilfered place, our bleating creatures in sense around, gnawing cocksfoot, ryegrass, phalaris grass, all of empire's weedy carpets. I backhoe Patterson's curse for days after your funeral, burning off its mauve emerald grip on a Sunday pyre. I clean slimy gutters and water tanks as if my life depends on it, won't pay young men from town to help, nor listen to our sockless city son, he of the neat suits and pale side part, who roars up one weekend to wrestle the filing cabinet's blank refusals of poetry. Going into administration, greenfield development, bankruptcy. I know our son will soon force the matter, neaten time into a rhymeless deal. He stares at my white hair and papery skin, my mothering surface become a paper to sign. Then we raise a glass to you, love, but one of us gets the rye grass staggers. I say, as he leaves, that I'm still strong enough to tackle all the invasive creep in the valley, the gin cup neighbour who won't burn, gorse or curse. Faded print of Streeton's early summer, gorse in bloom on his mantle, his grandfather's guns hanging north, south, east and west, like objet d'art, not evidence. I've already signed away half the land, sharing the precious boar with a hobby farmer who forgets to turn off the tap. My son folds me into a city suit hug, and I ask myself, to whom do I now declare the tracted bone and midden, the history of a road pushed through forest like a slow shot, the unquiet archive hidden?
I find that a very mysterious poem, actually. It seemingly yields its meaning immediately, yet my question to you is, what lies at the centre of this poem?
Good question, Tina. I suppose inheritance is a white word, isn't it? It's about inheriting the land, and the subject is a woman farmer who has lost her husband, sadly. The farm is basically going into receivership. All that is pending, and a lot of farms in Victoria have been sold off for what are called greenfield developments, for those small housing estates that dot the coast, which are kind of jerry-built, which offer very little community. So there's a sense of loss for this female farmer, that's for sure, and she's also grieving her husband. So that's the outward story. But for her, there's also the issue of leaving the land and somehow coming face to face with the fact that they were temporary there. They were settlers. And who will tell the story of the Midden, the road pushed through in 1848 to enable that farm to be? So there is a trace of white guilt in the coda there.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I'm speaking with Amanda Johnson about her latest poetry collection, Controlled Burn, published by Puncher and Wattman. I'd like to turn now to a poem from the second part of the collection, Peacekeeping. Would you read that poem for us?
Sure. Peacekeeping. Peace is rarely kept as a man, woman or ledger is kept. Has nothing to do with beekeeping, though protective suiting may enforce it. Peace is not kept like a sacrament inside a tabernacle or casket. It is not kept nice. Knowing this, she secretes food, books, blankets and water bottles. What she doesn't keep, a two-roomed house, three goats, a quarter share in a well, a husband taken in the night, hands tied tight with electrical cords, captors with one-week-old moustaches repeating, "You have not kept the faith, the faith." Days later, by her rock-walled garden, they visit again. "You'll keep," they say in their language. She answers boldly, "Keep what? What?" Her daughter plays in shadow, cast by spade and gun. Books are no longer permitted. That night, she sets out to a cousin's place in the mountains. There, her uncle has an old TV stuck on one channel. The TV talks of the implicit burden sharing around the refugee problem. She turns it off and rests. She doesn't trust the box of static, or believe that the dead radio will spring to life. She doesn't trust white-trucked UN convoys snaking through the valley like signs of an enemy's prophet. One morning, men appear at the pass below her uncle's house, moving through his small flock with knives, Kalashnikovs and bundle cords. It is the keepers. She grabs her daughter, takes off along the forest path behind the house. She brings a coil of her uncle's best rope, something strong and slack. After months of running in heat and cold, she comes close to Europe, where, she's been told, ties and bridges can be made. With others, she ties ropes together to cross a boiling river. This entails many willing keepers working both sides of the bank to make a knotted trapeze. Oh, lucky day! As she crosses the flushing torrent, heart hammering, child a shrieking weight, she thinks that this is what is meant by the English phrase, running away to the circus. People cheer, clap and shake, crying out to the old ones stranded a country apart. On the other side, she lies down at a border as clean and precise as a hair part. The air is fresh. She sleeps for hours under a silver sheet, guarded by rows of spindly pines. When she arrives at a camp, rich soil becomes stone and pebble, a sprouting garden of bright plastic. She keeps her peace about the stuffy NGO issue tent, but it is so hot, her dreams guy with new roped terrors. Each day she wakes exhausted. There's no news of her husband's lovely young eyes. Goatee radio voices announce that, while peace has not come, the dog remains hopeful on his chain. Politicians tour, groomed faces sorrowing, as if to say, what is kept? Kept here is burdensome. The tired clinic nurse, mispronouncing their names, inoculates. The psychologist suggests ritual patience, though her daughter won't go to school alone. The walls of plastic don't harden into a village. She sleeps with a bar by the bed. One day, a message comes. The message is for her alone, a chance of roped reunion. She greets her daughter at the school with hugs, knows she was right to keep her uncle's rope. Something strong and slack, a coiled future to cast over all the rivers on the planet.
How do people survive unimaginable circumstances? Is there hope even in the darkest moments?
I did draw the account of that poem from Syrian refugees. It just struck me, the risks, my God, you know, they're so enormous. There is a note of optimism at the end, and that there's the possibility of reunion with the young husband. I guess it's an elegy, Tina, for the sufferings endured, and that's all I can do as a poet, even though it's a little problematic of me to try and inhabit the head of someone enduring that trauma. But I just had to write it. You know, I felt like I wanted to make a symbolic character that could be from any theatre of war, particularly at a time when refugees were flooding into Europe from numerous ports and being the victims of people smugglers. And I was in Europe at that time myself, so I was a witness to the impacts of that on the street.
Quite a few poems in the collection deal with art. Could you read The Colour of Fog, which takes Monet as its subject?
This is a ekphrastic poem in the sense that it reflects on Claude Monet's Thames embankment views from 1901. So he was an established painter by then. He travelled to London with his son Michael and his wife Alice, and they're actually mourning the death of a child. So you'll meet Alice in this poem. You'll meet their son Michael, and the elephant in the room, I guess, is the dead child. So in a way, it's a poem that updates the great man to reflect on Alice's role in his life. The Colour of Fog. You woke, scratched your ample arse and abluted, looked askance at the tray of grey buttered haddock and mud pond coffee. No good cure for Alice. Her colourless fog, rivaling the vaporous street, filling formal room after formal room. You too are half smothered by loss, a stepdaughter now singing under Giverny lime. Quick, convert airless memory into earth tone. Van Dyke brown, burnt umber, raw, raw. But you hated those hues anyway. The English city miasma made Alice cough. Modern grief, a good thing. Progress, pure raw umber. You took cigars in the hide-bound lobby where smoke coiled and purred around the felt shoulders of captains of industry. Your son, Michel, profiting brown English verbs. To win, to pay, produce, modernise, control, collect. Oh, yes, monsieur, my lovely mother collects art. That's what you did back then. Cashed up, you booked two rooms at the Savoy, one to sleep in, one to paint in, relying on a smog-sweetened palette for your effects. Waterloo Bridge, Parliament, factory chimneys, and a Thames steeped in purple, mauve and yellow, the poisons of new capital. Most days, fog baffles the catarrh of workers hugging the bridges, their dye-vat lungs flecked blue and vermilion, as evening and the robust obfuscations of the phlegmatic class close in. When the jaundiced air grows quiet, you boil up rabbit skin glue on the burner, tighten 80 canvases into resounding drums of the world, oblivious to chambermaid eye rolls as the foul stink leaches down velvet corridors. Grief, or intolerance of grief, provokes the serial images your friend Pizarro will chastise. London, Riverside, on repeat? Mad. When you crate them up to send them home, half-finished, Alice rises in her bed, ghost hand searching your face. But suddenly, happy. Happy as an opium poppy. En route to Dover, train smokes an unusable no-colour. Distracted, you smooth Alice's black brows away. At home, you finish each work from memory. This is just before your lilies erupt. The debts to your English veils is bridal. Whites, pinks and mauves. Landscape, fogged. Alice, listless in the hammock, nods, catching sun in her hair. Seven children gathering to pull at her as if she were a loom they would prize apart. Her darling Luddites, seeking flesh, cloth, bone and equitable love. Her impossible canvas. And you now, cataract frantic, on Nymphaeus number 91 and Nymphaeus 92. Failing to see or hear her, grafting a moody dash of English smog to your living, pondered world. Bodily machine, still bright as a gas lamp. Underpainting, fading in the artless dusk, like gift shop tea towels, out of time.
It really puts the great artist within a network of relationships, doesn't it?
Beautifully put, Tina, actually. I think so, because I never really knew much about Camille and Alice. Camille's the earlier partner. And I love his work myself. And you kind of think, oh, not another impressionist. Is that a subject for a poetry in 2026? My way in was to really talk about the women.
Being a painter yourself, what draws you to write poems about art?
Ekphrasis has been around for a long time, whereby poets evoke an artwork or a sculpture or even a performance in poetry. And I've always done that a little separately to studio practice, actually. So if I'm working on an exhibition, I tend not to write about those works, for example. I write about the works of other people. But it's a dynamic form, I guess, and it gives you an instant subject which you could explore in so many different ways, you know, whether it's the political or social context or the material context of the work, the gender of the person who made the work may be relevant. It's a really pleasurable process. It's also an imagistic process because in relating to the work, I suppose you have to find textual equivalents. You have to make your own little poetic paintings within the poem. So it's great fun.
Thank you, Amanda.
It's a pleasure, Tina.
I'm Tina Janoukas. You've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I've been speaking with Amanda Johnson about her poetry collection, Controlled Burn, published by Puncher and Wattman. Controlled Burn is available online. Spoken Word broadcasts every Thursday at 9 a.m. on 855 a.m. Thank you for listening.